Welcome to City Club of Eugene's March 15th, 2019 program, From Bart and Grover to Bethany Grace, Navigating and Studying Gender Transition. This is the 24th program of our 2018-2019 programming year. I'm Joel Curran, president of City Club. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club by going to our website at cityclubofeugene.org. Our diamond sponsors are Kaiser Permanente, who exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care and to improve the health of their members and the communities they serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support also comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health. Their mission is to their shared purpose, since they were founded in more than 125 years ago, to promote personal and community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, to treat each person in a loving and caring way. For more information, visit peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor today is Palo Alto Software. For more than 20 years, Palo Alto has had a commitment to educating and empowering entrepreneurs and small businesses. With their headquarters in Eugene, they are best known for LivePlan, a lean planning software tool. More information at paloalto.com. This has been a big week in news for the transgender community. Here in Oregon, new legislation has been signed saying that being transgender is not an illness or a disability. They've also changed the rules regarding birth certificates to allow folks who have gone through transition to get a birth certificate conforming to their desired gender. On the other hand, the armed forces, following the lead of the president, has made it harder for transgender individuals to get into the military or serve in the military. To discuss personal issues and issues relating to the transgender community, we have with us today Bethany Grace Howe. I first met Bethany sitting in the wonderful Eugene Institution of Sam Bond's garage and watching her on stage doing stand-up comedy. Thank you. Thank you to the Sam Bond's people in the audience and to the improv people in the audience. Like many comedians, Bethany discussed personal issues, going through transition, the issues that she faced and overcame. But more than a comedian, no one in Eugene is better equipped to talk about these issues, both from her personal experience and from her study. She is a PhD candidate and will receive her PhD in the spring. And her field of study has been studying transgender communities around the country. She has been, and luckily for us, she posts to Facebook about all her journeys. On the table is an indicator of is Bethany's more complete bio about all the things that she's done, getting to the point where today she's just a couple months from getting her doctorate degree. But the most intriguing part for me in her background, and maybe what prepared her for Eugene, is that in college, she served as the mascot for the University of Missouri, known as Truman, and also served as a major league mascot as Dinger, the Denver
Colorado
Rockies baseball team. I mean, that's on par with the Philly, for me, from Philadelphia, with the Philly fanatic and gritty. So I now give you Bethany Grace Howe.
Yeah, those were some sweaty times. From Barton Grover to Bethany Grace, it's I don't think about it like that much, but it's an interesting construct. And so, you know, like Joel said, I do stand up, and stand up for me is a release. It's kind of laugh or cry, crying is just so dehydrating, even in Eugene. And so a lot of this is, you know, I was thinking about my stand-up routine, but I was also thought about kind of, okay, what infuses that? What makes that? And so this is kind of a little bit of stand-up, a little bit of research, a little bit of, who knows. I was a high school teacher here in Oregon. I don't know if any of you all have ever been to Lincoln City. It's 7 miles of traffic interrupted by traffic lights. And it's a wonderful town to be a teacher because in the summer, when it's complete gridlock, I didn't have to work. And I was not exactly living what you would call a binary life, a normal life in terms of, I was the town drag queen, which, again, is not being transgender, but it was as close as I could come. And I was a terrible drag queen. I don't know if you've ever been to drag shows here in town, but they're up entertaining, and they're dancing, and they're singing. And all I wanted to do was sit at the bar and read a feminism book. And people would be like, what are you singing tonight? And I'd be like, well, I'm thinking about maybe I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar by Helen Reddy. And that really is not going to get you a lot of tips. And so I was a terrible drag queen. And yet, that's sort of the space I was occupying. Because for me, at that point, transgender was not a word that most people used. It was not I'm not saying it didn't exist, but in terms of public consciousness, including my own, it just wasn't an option. And so I kind of lived this life where I realized now I was acting out who I wanted to be. And it always cracked me up because, like, I'll never forget one time a kid came into my classroom. This was a fairly new student. Everybody in town knew I was the town drag queen. And this kid asked me, because I had a pink coffee mug, and he said, aren't you worried people are going to think you're gay? And I'm like, yeah, I don't think that's the coffee mug that's going to pull that off. But, you know, it was hard. And so when Caitlyn Jenner popped up on the cover of Vanity Fair, I was actually sitting in my classroom, and I had one of these classrooms that's completely wired with, like, televisions and screens. And so I pulled that Vanity Fair cover up, and it... boink, you know, it's up on an 80-inch monitor, and all my students were like, wow. And about half a dozen of them came to me and said, so you gonna do that? And I was like, no. It's kind of like, you know, when you ask somebody when they're due, and as it turns out, they're not, and it's just sort of that awkward silence. Yeah, well, this was an awkward silence from somebody that could flunk them. So they went on their merry way, but, you know, it got me thinking. And so that was when I was wrapping up my teaching career and I was coming over here to the University of Oregon to start my PhD. And one of the things is, as I started kind of investigating what it means to be transgender, was looking at research. Well, you can't look at research. If any of you are ever familiar with researching, it's hidden behind so many paywalls that I'm convinced they'll discover a cure for cancer someday and we won't know it for years because it's hidden behind a paywall. Being at the university, I suddenly had access to all of that. And suddenly there was, I understood who I was. I understood what it meant to be me. And it really was very quick. I went from telling people in September, well, to put this in perspective, the day before I got my first ID photo taken, my hair was about this long from a summer of not cutting it off. And I went to the barber shop and pretty much had it shaved down to here. And to this day, I still miss those 3 inches. My hair should always be 3 inches longer because I was stupid. And so that was kind of a point where I went through several months where I was kind of living this duality. I knew who I was, and I did not tell a living soul. You know, it just, I realize now this was foolish, but it was like, okay, I just got a fellowship. Am I going to lose it? Am I going to get tossed out of the university? I was divorcing from my wife over things that were unrelated. And it was like, am I going to lose custody of my daughter? I mean, there was just an insane amount of self-doubt. And I realize now that a lot of that was, I wouldn't say ridiculous, but it was misguided. But I didn't know that at the time. And so I'm kind of living this dual life. And so I'm flying home to Colorado to tell my parents. And I kind of had all my girly stuff in a bag and a big old padded bra and all that stuff. And so naturally, you know what happens at security at the airport. That's the bag they want to unpack. And so this guy is pulling out my stuff, and he's holding it up, and he's looking at it, and he's, like, squeezing it. Apparently, I was going to keep explosives in there. I'm not sure. And I'm looking at this, and the only thought I could have is, huh, somebody is finally feeling up my chest, and I'm not even there to enjoy it. And, you know, it was uncomfortable. It was, I mean, again, everyone is just looking, and you're just kind of like, good to see you. I mean, it's Portland, so whatever. But, you know, up there, that just made me a hipster. But I think the thing is that it highlighted for me just how everything got really complicated and really awkward. I mean, don't get me wrong, going through security is never fun. But now it was something I stressed out about a lot. And I would say that's one of the things that's absolutely changed. I recently spent, I don't know, I fly a lot. I'd say I'm on a plane an average of once a month, maybe sometimes twice a month. And I couldn't care less about TSA anymore. At the Eugene airport, they all know me. You know, it's like, hey, long time no see. And at the bigger airports, I just don't care anymore. And I will admit, I think I make them nervous. I think they get memos about how not to, please do not harass the transgender people. You're going to get us sued. And I always love it when they're patting you down. It's like, you know, they're doing this thing with their hands. It's like, you know, the Karate Kid, wax on, wax off. And it's like they pat you down with their fingernails. It's like, okay, so whatever. And, you know, if you've ever been patted down at the airport, they sort of try to be sensitive around your, you know, for lack of a better word, private parts. Well, you know, I'm visibly transgender. I don't think they know where mine are. So everything that I do makes them nervous. I giggle when they sweep my armpit just to throw them off. And I think that's one of the things I would say is that, you know, I'm learning to look on the bright side of life, I guess. I mean, I'll say it. I still hate the airport. I still hate security. But I'm not going to be intimidated by it anymore. But it is, you do exist in a certain space of, I wouldn't say paranoia, but you do, every single thing that happens, you wonder if it's a point of contention. You wonder if it's something about you. And I will never forget, I was at Costco, and there was this kid giving me the dirtiest looks. And I just was like, that is so not cool. So I did the responsible, mature thing, and I stalked them through Costco, which is a great place to stalk people because all you got to do is just hang near the sample carts and everybody comes to you. You don't even have to follow them. And so I waited. And finally, you know, this kid, again, looked right at me and just this incredible sneer on their face. But the more I watched, the more I realized they weren't sneering at me. They just were an ugly child. And that made me feel better. It wasn't me. It was everyone. But again, it just... It gets wearing a little bit, and I'm a parent, and my daughter is 8, and she is an advocate. To say that she supports me unconditionally is an understatement. She will say to people, "That's my daddy. She was a boy, but she wasn't happy. And now she's a girl and she's happier." And I love it when she does that. I'm not sure why she has to tell the gas station attendant at Costco. So sometimes I now lock the window, the power windows, and she's like, "Why don't these roll down?" And I'm like, "I don't know, honey, it must be broken." But, you know, and she said to me one day, this was probably 3 years ago, she said, "Daddy, I wish you'd never transitioned." And I was like, "Why?" I said, "I mean, it just broke my heart." And she said, "Well, because when you were a boy, we had money, and now we're poor." And I said, honey, that's because I'm a PhD student and I gave up a job to go back to college. Oh, you mean we're not going to be this way forever? No. Oh, well, then I don't care. It's like, great. But you do wonder the different things that go through her head. For a while, she calls me daddy, which throws some people. But she didn't want to call me anything else, and I didn't want to be called anything else. I waited until I was 42 to become a parent. I'd waited my whole life to be called daddy, and I wasn't giving it up. And I also realized it was kind of useless. I will never forget one of the first times I went out, and I mean, I really worked at looking good and went to the Home Depot just to buy something. And I pulled it off. And then as we're standing there at checkout, she looks up at me and she goes, daddy, can I have a Reese's? And I'm just like, So the gig's up. And the truth is I, the only reason I was going to change it was because society doesn't accept that as a norm. And I've kind of decided I don't care. Now, I care in certain places. Like we have agreed, please don't yell out daddy when we're in the women's restroom. When she does that, you can actually hear every other person in the bathroom actually stop breathing for a minute. I don't need to cause that kind of stress. We try to be respectful of spaces. But bathrooms are kind of a funny source of contention because, you know, there's been like bathroom bills across the country about what bathroom I'm allowed to use and that kind of thing. And when I came out, my advisor at the University of Oregon asked me, they said, so, how do you feel about being the transgender poster child for the School of Journalism? And I was like, cool. Do we get jackets? We did not. But his point was that you are going to get bombarded. You are the most highly visible member of a demographic group that is a topic of discussion, and everybody is going to want to talk to you. Everybody's going to want a piece of you. And in a journalism school where you have hundreds of young people running around looking to do stories, I'm pretty easy to find. And every time a bathroom bill passes somewhere, they come looking for me. And I don't know. I guess I'm kind of tired of it. I mean, I'm so much more than my opinion on bathrooms. And so I've sort of, and I've told their instructors I do this, and they're fine with it because they think it's a valuable lesson for them to learn. Their students will come and ask me about bathrooms, and I'll say, well, I got to be honest with you. I'm outraged. I said, at the tuition you pay, the toilet paper that's in these bathrooms, it's horrendous. And you're an out-of-state student. They should just give you a truck of Charmin when you get here to balance it out because you're getting screwed. And they look at me like, are they serious? And I'm like, you know, and I want them to understand that there is more to being a transgender individual and the violation of my civil rights than just a bathroom. They do find it funny because we have a gender-neutral bathroom at the university in the building. In fact, all buildings on campus now have a gender-neutral bathroom, which I think is fantastic. And so they asked me my opinion on that. And my opinion is it's a really nice bathroom. It has magazines and a chair, and I never use it. And they find this fascinating. They're like, but it's there. And it's like, okay, I don't need to use it. A, the women's bathroom is just fine. B, I work on the third floor. That bathroom is on the first floor. I wear heels. I'm 50 years old. I have a bladder the size of a walnut. I'm not going up and down the stairs every time I got to pee. That's all I do in this building. And the reason I mention this is just because, again, I think sometimes transgender people just get reduced to an identity. And one of the things I've started telling students over there is, look, I'm happy to talk to you. You can interview me. You can do a story about me. But can you please not make this about the fact that I'm transgender? If you want to do a story about the fact that I drive a convertible and my wig blew off in the highway, that's okay. I miss that convertible and the wig, too. If you want to do a story on me and my daughter, if you want to do a story about my life and one aspect of it is being transgender, I'm happy to do that. But it just can't be news anymore that I exist. And the reason I do that to them is, well, A, I'm mean. But I want them to understand that people are more than their identity. And I think people get tired of being tokenized. And what I mean by that is just, you know, I went from the top of the totem pole of privilege, a white guy living in America, to let's just say not being at the top anymore. Where I fell, I don't exactly know, certain days myself. But I have ideas, I have thoughts that go well beyond my identity, and those are just as much a part of me. If you ask me, if somebody said, "What's your identity?" I'll always tell people the first thing is, "I'm a daddy. I'm my daughter's father, and everything else comes after that." And sometimes I think we tend to forget that. And I've noticed that. I was talking to an African American student of mine, and she said, "The minute people find out I'm from Southern California, they all want to know where I live in Compton." And she's like, "I don't live in Compton. All the black people in California do not live in Compton." But that's just kind of what she deals with. And so, you know, and I've started noticing these different things just about some of the other diverse communities I work with on campus. I think maybe the one thing I do see is being transgender in the 21st century is I sometimes feel like we're the boogeyman du jour. The gay marriage battle is over. We won. And I can't tell you that there's an agenda, so to speak, but I do think, and this is true of politics of any kind, a lot of times politics is not about just what you're for, it's what you can rally opposition against. And I think with the gay marriage battle over, it was, okay, what are we going to rally opposition to now? And I sometimes feel that my identity is less about people understanding me and more of me just being an agenda topic. We don't know who you are, but we know what you're not, and you're not us, therefore. And so that gets frustrating. I won't lie to you. The worst days I have, and I have some profoundly bad days, are when I feel like my community is under siege, because I don't feel like I'm under siege much at all. I'm in a liberal school on a liberal university in a very liberal city in a fairly liberal state. I'm about as inured, immune from the daily problems of being transgender as you get, but I'm keenly aware that many of my peers are not that lucky. And so I think that's what affects me most, is just sometimes I see the things that are happening and it's like, okay, I don't feel like this is happening because it responds to any real societal need or science or anything valid. It's simply somebody's agenda item because they need something to rally against, and that happens to be me. I think the other thing is, and this is kind of the key of my dissertation research, and it's kind of funny. Sometimes my humor arises from my experiences and my research. I can honestly say that probably the most important thing I've ever figured out as a scholar stems from the kind of the comedic way I look at the world, and that is that I was kind of sitting there one night in bed, it's probably like 3 a.m, couldn't sleep, working on a paper, and I was like, God, I am the only person who has to prove that I exist. And what I mean by that is that, well, like the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, a delightful group of people that seem to be rising again somewhere, they obviously dislike African Americans, they dislike the Jewish community, and yet they acknowledge they exist. I don't even get that. I'm a mental illness. I am a predator lurking in the bathroom. I am a phase. When people want to say that being transgender is not real, it does not exist, that is their response. That none of this is real, this is all in my head, whether it's in my head subconsciously or consciously, whatever it is, it's not real. And you find that narrative of proof embeds itself in a lot of things. I mean, my mom, who is the most supportive woman in the entire world, I mean, God bless her, she's 75, my dad's 80. This was not what they planned on. Although, like I say, my mom is incredibly supportive. I had gender confirmation surgery, and the morning I woke up at OHSU, there was a big pink Mylar balloon in my room, and it said, "It's a girl!" And I still have the balloon. Yeah. But my poor mom, we were talking, and she said, "Are you sure you're not gay like all my other friends' kids?" And I was like, "No, Mom, I'm not gay. But when I finish my transition, I will be a lesbian." And she just was, "What?" And I was like, Okay, can we finish the dishes? I think this is a conversation best had over a bottle of scotch. And that's what we did. But she is. She's incredibly supportive. But every once in a while, she'll just say to me something like, you know, if you want people to think you're a real woman, you should probably learn to walk like one. Or I get a lot of comments on my voice because I obviously still skew closer to Barry White than I do Barbara Streisand. And that is, and I understand where it comes from, but it's deadening to hear because my identity as a woman, I figured it out in fall of 2015 that this is who I was. And that was the day that I was like, okay, I am a transgender woman. And some people don't even consider transgender necessary. I still do. I guess I find some comfort in it. But I am no more or less a transgender woman now than I was then. I've had top surgery and bottom surgery, as they say. My hair has grown out. I've gotten a lot better at makeup. I have 32 pairs of shoes, and I only wear 5 of them. So I feel very much like a woman. But I'm no more a woman now than I was then. And so that kind of narrative of realness, that narrative of proof that I need to dress a certain way, sound a certain way, do certain things to be considered a woman, it's hard. And the reason I say that is not just because, well, I realized this. And so I said to myself, okay, I call it transgender identity defense related emotions. And those are the emotions generated when somebody eventually, when someone essentially challenges, not only that you're unequal, but not only that you're not equal, but that you don't exist. And so that's what I've spent the last 6 months doing is traveling all over the United States, interviewing transgender people and surveying them both quantitatively and qualitatively. And it's absolutely there. And the more these types of incidents, what they call microaggressions, these microaggressive incidents happen to transgender people, the more damaging they are. And I could go into all the data, but the more it happens, and the more it happens directed by somebody that you care about. I don't get too worked up about being mocked by the kid at the Steak and Shake. I'm just, you know, if I feel really petty, I'm going to go back later on and squish ketchup packets all over the bathroom. But I can get over that. But when it comes from somebody who's close to me, even if it's inadvertent like it is in the case with my mom, that hurts more. And the more those types of painful things happen, the more likely a transgender person is to societally disengage in activities, emotionally withdraw from the social space around them. And in the latest study that we did, if you ask people to rate on a scale from 1 to 7 how intensely something makes them feel emotionally, it's like, okay, this is a 1, it's no big deal. A 7 is, that's really intense. And so we asked people all these different microaggressive incidents, and then we looked at the numbers through a very complicated procedure that my co-author understands. And when you go from 1 to 2, the rate of suicidal ideation goes up 49%. When you go from 2 to 3, it goes up another 49, 3 to 4, another 49, and so on, 6 to 7, 49%. It is like this. And that's not my life. It is not my life living here in Eugene, Oregon to have to deal with that. But it is the life of most transgender people. And transgender people, in most surveys, and in my research as well, 90% of them have thought about it. 40% of them have tried it. I'm one of the 90%. As much as I'm supported at the University of Oregon and to be perfectly honest, loved by the people there, I had to check out for 2 weeks, leave campus, go to a nice little mental health facility in Aspen. And if you're ever going to do that, go during low season rates, so much cheaper. As great as I have it, I still go through it. And so, like I say, as I joke about a lot of things, beats crying about it. But, you know, this is not easy. The best quote I heard was, you know, it's totally worth it, but this ain't for sissies. So what questions can I ask? And I will say this, ask me anything you want. I've done Q&A presentations to literally thousands of people all the way from elementary school students to, you know, people in their 70s, 80s. And I won't say you could ask a question I haven't heard, but I've heard a lot of them, and I don't get offended. I don't get bothered. This is a forum to learn and teach, and we should do that. I'm going to get a cookie.
You earned it. Thank you very much. We'll now take a break for table discussion.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Okay, welcome back to the March 15th, 2019 program from Barton Grover to Bethany Grace, Navigating and Studying Gender Transition. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our gold sponsors, Banner Bank, Jerry Detelm, architect and landscape architect, Luvas Cobb, Network Charter School, and our in-kind sponsors, KRVM, Dot Dotson's Photography, PacInfo, and Simplified Computing LLC. And thanks to the McKenzie Willamette Medical Center and Peterson Pacific Corporation for hosting this week's session on Oh, the Places You Will Go, a course on teachers who want to learn more about the local economy and the work it offers. City Club partners with the Eugene and Springfield Chambers, Lane Workforce Partnership, and the Lane Education Service District. And as always, thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday night, and to Community Television of Lane County, Channel 29, for televising our City Club programs. We will now go to questions. Please keep your questions to 1 minute, and we have time for a lot of questions, so let's get started. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Annie. I am a student from Network Charter School, one of today's sponsors. And my question is, what did your wife think of the change in the transition?
Well, we're divorced, so no. You know, it's interesting. A lot of marriages survive the gender transition of one of the spouses. It is not a rare thing. In the case of my marriage, there's the metaphor of the straw that broke the camel's back. This was the anvil that flattened it into a horse. And just our marriage was already pretty fractured ahead of time for just a whole bunch of reasons. And this was just it. But one of the reasons was, and I hear this articulated with a lot of people that are married, is that your sexual orientation doesn't change when you transition. I mean, I was married to a woman, and I'm still attracted to women. So I went from being straight to being a lesbian overnight. Yay. But my wife did not go from being straight to being a lesbian. And she had a real problem with being seen as a lesbian. And when you talk to married couples that stay together, one of the biggest stressors on the relationship is the other person learning to be identified as a lesbian or a gay person, because they got married as a straight person and then the other person transitioned. So now visually, that's who they are. They're not. They're still in love with the soul of the human being that they've been in love with forever. But societally, that's now a label dropped on them. And that is a lot for some people to handle. And that was, let's put it this way, like I say, it was already fractured. That was the thing that broke it completely apart. We're amicable. We talk. We're raising our daughter together. You know, but yeah, I'm pretty sure she would have us gotten divorced the normal way. Next.
Hi, my name is Sawyer. I'm a student at Network Charter School, and I'm a sponsor here today.
I like your charter school.
I like it too. How do you deal emotionally with a parent who doesn't really realize that they're being transphobic or queerphobic?
Well, there's the question of the year. You know, I think it's a sliding scale. And when I told my parents, honestly, my parents live in Boulder, Colorado, which is just like Eugene. Our rivers are smaller and our mountains are higher, but that's about it. Yeah, the average house there costs $1 million. It doesn't here, which is why I'm here and not there. They're very liberal, very socially liberal. This absolutely blew them out of the water. This was not something they saw coming. And so even among two parents that were incredibly open and accepting of the idea, it scared them to death. My mom thought I was going to get beaten up. The first time she ever saw me dressed as a woman, I remember she said, "Huh, that's not half bad." And it was like, "You like me. You really like me." And I think for my mom, it was the realization that I wasn't going to be a victim of violence. That made her feel better. For my dad, it was, okay, you're about to go spend $60,000 on an education. No one's going to hire you. I'm going to get hired. And so my dad is fine. And so I think a lot of parents are motivated by fear. And the question is, where does that fear become intolerance? And I wish I had an easy answer. If you're talking about your family or the family of somebody you know, what I would suggest is really try to understand their motivation. And if it's fear, that's something you can help them work through. If it's just pure intolerance, I wish I could tell you that all those stories have happy endings, but they don't. It's obviously a longer answer, and I'm happy to answer it longer if you want to talk after this. I don't know if you have to get back to school, but I don't.
Wendy?
My name is Wendy Wheeler Coltrane. I've been a member for a while, long while. My question is, how long have you known that you really are a female? And what kinds of clues gave you that sense, even before you actually 4 years ago said, "I'm a woman"?
I didn't know until September, October of 2015. And one of the things about being transgender is there is the narrative. It's called the wrong body discourse. And it's Caitlyn Jenner, Laverne Cox. I grew up knowing I was in the wrong body my whole life. That is not me. I can look back now in my life and see moments where I felt just this acute sense of gender dysphoria. Just like, there is something wrong with this. But it passed. And what I mean by that is, like, along with being a sports mascot, I was also a performer for Disney on Ice. And we were in Japan, and all the girls went out. And I wanted to go with the girls, and they basically said, "You can't go, because this is girls' night, and you're not a girl." And I just, the feeling that I should be with them was so acute that it just, I was depressed. But it was also like 2 days later, it's like, well, there's not a thing you can do about it, so move on. And that's kind of how a lot of my life was. I would have these moments of just profound dislocation, but then it was, there's nothing you can do about it, move on. And so I can tell you what I call anomalies. I can look back on my life and see anomalies that are sprinkled here and there through my narrative for 47 years. When did I understand that meant I was transgender? The first time was Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair, and I thought, that's interesting. And that progressed over 5 months to, okay. So my story is very atypical, but what I would say about that is it is so atypical that I couldn't find it in media. And because I couldn't see it, I couldn't find it, I thought there really was something more wrong with me. I mean, when the counselor at the testing center said to me, "Yeah, you can be transgender and not have known it till now," I burst out in tears because it was like, oh, so for being statistically completely abnormal, I'm normal. Yay. There's a research person for you. Yeah.
That's a good segue. Scott Coltrane, City Club member for a year. I'm interested in your dissertation. So if you could talk a little bit more about what the central questions are, particularly interested in what kind of sampling strategy did you use? You're going all over the country. And what are you worried about bias, the kinds of transgender people that you're locating swaying one way or the other? Talk a little bit about that.
In a nutshell, my dissertation is transgender identity defense-related emotions and their connection to media and interpersonal microaggressions. In other words, the things we hear every day and encounter every day, whether from other people or media, is what I referred to earlier. It just emotionally damages you to the point that you're just done. In some cases, you're literally done with life. The way I sampled it was twofold. One, my partner and I did a quantitative survey over last summer, and we put this thing up in every single place we could think of. Transgender Facebook pages, Reddit posts, Instagram. I reached out to activists in the transgender community that have a much further reach than I did, and they put the survey up themselves. And so when it was all said and done, we had a dispersal about among 35 states. Inside of those 35 states, I found what I would call clusters of people that had found it. Maybe they posted it to a Facebook page and they all shared it with their friends. I don't know. But from those clusters, I said, okay, I want to talk to people in different parts of the country, because I'll bet being transgender in Eugene is very different than being transgender in Dallas, Texas. So I said, okay. And so I said, all right, the Caitlyn Jenner Foundation gave me a check and said, go travel. So I went to Dallas, a big city in a red state. I went to New York, a big city in a blue state. I went to Albuquerque, a small city in a purple state. I went to Spokane, a small blue city in a very red portion of the world, Eastern Washington. And then I went to Louisville, which is this sort of very blue city in a very red area, but it's evolving. And then in each one of those places, I talked to anywhere from 10 to 15 people and just said, okay, I've got your survey. This is what you put. You put this bothers you, this doesn't. This hurts you. This just bums you out. Tell me why. Why is this a problem? Why is this not? And from there, I ended up doing 66 interviews. And so what I have now is the survey data of 225 transgender people, and then the qualitative data based on interviews with 66 of those people. And with the exception of one thing, I found exactly the same thing with the quant as I did with the qualitative, and even the quantitative, the one where it doesn't match up, I think I have an explanation for it. I just need to run some more numbers. Yeah, it's been an adventure. I basically left home Labor Day, came home for about 5 weeks over the course of the rest of the year, and flew home from New York City Christmas Eve. So it was great. I talked to an African-American woman in the Bronx who started quoting Judith Butler and Michael Foucault, and she just said, I kind of looked at her and said, not what you expect from a sex worker in the Bronx, is it? And I said, that's not what I expect from anyone who's not a pretentious PhD. Where did you learn that? And she said, in school. You learned that in high school? No, middle school. I was on the debate team. Of course you did. So I learned a lot. Yeah.
You know he's secretly a sociologist.
Oh, yes. Many
about
people
fatherhood.
Are.
About, that's his thing. Dad. Okay. I'm Mary Layton. I've been a member for 1,000 years and the principal of Network Charter School
Thank
at one time.
Thank you for bringing your students.
Well, they came. So, one of the students wanted to know, how did your subsequent partners react to your being trans?
In terms of, like, relationships. That would require that I've had a subsequent.
It seemed like there was no time.
Yeah. Dating while trans is always amusing. I'll say it. You put your face up on one of those, like, dating sites, and you get an enormous number of people. It's like you're on their bucket list. So, you know, a lot of people get onto like match.com and they write like this cutesy paragraph. I wrote like a 2-page lecture basically saying, here's all the reasons I don't want to talk to you. And it worked effectively because nobody's wanted to talk to me. Between raising my daughter, between being a PhD student, between all the traveling, between my research, I haven't had time to date. But again, I, being a quant geek, I ran the statistics based on demographics and different polling data. And when I got the stats back, I was talking to a friend of mine. He said, do you really want to know? And I was like, yeah, what are the odds that I'm ever going to get married again? He said, they're like 1 in 400. And I was like, so you're saying there's a chance? and that's kind of how I feel about it. It's probably not going to happen. And I won't lie. That makes me kind of sad. But the flip side of it is I have a great life. I have a network of friends here in town that are truly, they're my sisters, and that's how I think of it. And I got my daughter, and she's my trusty sidekick, and if I live out my life single with this community of friends and family, I couldn't be happier. So yeah, and that's the beauty of not passing. You know, a lot of people that pass, it's like, you know, at some point I got to tell them I'm transgender. I don't ever have to have that conversation. I mean, unless I'm dating someone who's deaf. That's the only way I think that's going to happen. So, yeah.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Shorak-Petty, a member since August. So I am a recently retired high school teacher, and every year I observed students who were going through a transition or wanted to transition. Lovely students, but, you know, confused and just searching for what's right. And what I'm wondering is, at what age do you think it is okay to start a transition? And would it be wise to wait until you're in your 20s, just in case you're just depressed about life in general, or, you know, there are so many Facebook groups now that maybe one should wait till one is a little older? I mean, students, it took you a long time to figure it out, but there are so many now who at a very young age are already saying, I want to change. So what would you recommend in that case as far as the physical? I mean, I observed the voices changing. Students were already having treatments when they were 14.
Yeah. The evidence shows that the vast majority of kids that elect that say they're transgender are. And it's what goes back to my basic thing is, if somebody says they're transgender, believe them. And I'm not going to tell you, and nothing is ever that simple. But in terms of what we know about students who say they want to transition, the vast majority of them know what it is they want. And I can tell you, I mean, one of my pet peeves when people say, well, have you really thought about this? When you live your life in opposition to everything around you, all you do is think about it. I have thought about this more than I've thought about anything in my life, and thank God the University of Oregon let me get a PhD in it, so it was worth it. But when people say, well, you really haven't thought about it, no, these kids have thought about it. But here's the other thing. If you just purely want to look at it statistically, okay, what percentage of kids that say they want to transition ultimately elect to do something else? Whatever that percentage is, it's quite low. It's like in the single digits. Last I read, there's different studies. Contrast that with what happens when kids say they want a gender transition and their families don't support them and their schools don't believe them. We know that at least half the time they will try to kill themselves. So purely from a statistical standpoint, the damage that you do to a collective group of 100 kids that say, I want to transition, by believing all 100 of them, yes, you may find 5 or 6 that say, man, it turns out that's not what I wanted. And then there are complications possibly that go from that. At the other end of the spectrum, if you say to those 100 kids, okay, we don't believe you and you want to wait until you're 20, you can assume that by the time they're 20, 40% of them will have tried to kill themselves, 90% of them will have thought about it and wrecked their lives in the process. So to me, it's a simple, beyond just decency, it's a matter of numbers. Believe them.
My name is Camilla Pratt. I'm a member of City Club. Bethany, what was it like to get help from the medical community in your transition?
It was, and again, this is where my experience is insanely different. I've had all of my medical care, other than my surgeries, at the Health and Testing Center at the university campus. And I'll never forget, I went in. I am naturally about as hairy as an ape. I am the missing link. And so the first time I ever just shaved it all off, I bought enough razors that Bic stock went up. But also, I got 9 ingrown hairs right here in my armpit. And so I did what you do when you have an ingrown hair that you've shaved off all your hairs for and you don't want to tell anyone. I ignored it. And after 2 weeks, I couldn't lift my arm. So I finally went into the health clinic at the campus. And the doctor said, well, okay, first, I wouldn't shave your body again. And I said, that's going to be a problem. And she said, oh, well, I'm the transgender health specialist. Glad to meet you. And it was that simple. My care over there has been exemplary. I have 0 complaints, and I know other people do. But I have never been misgendered over there. I have never been mistreated over there. I have never been ignored over there. Her name's Mary Allison Smith. And I have to stop seeing her when I graduate. I am depressed.
She is my friend. She invites me over for Christmas Eve dinner. So that's my that's probably not every student. Most transgender people, that is not their experience. They are denied. They are mistreated. In fact, I'm on a panel in October at a university conference talking about the massive stress that it puts on transgender people when the medical community either does not acknowledge or fails to properly acknowledge their identity. But that's never happened to me, and I am the luckiest woman on earth.
My name is Sharon Reed. I'm a member of City Club. First, also, I appreciated your facilitation of the conversation with Caitlyn Jenner when she was here. Oh. So I saw that online, so thank you. It was very informative.
You bet.
I'm asking this on behalf of one of the Network Charter School students. How do you feel about transgender hormones not being covered by insurance?
I think it's ridiculous. Medical coverage in terms of insurance and how it relates to transgender people is this constantly evolving thing. And I wish I could tell you that being transgender is the only realm in which insurance companies get cheap. But what I can also tell you is it is evolving. I mean, they absolutely should. And in fact, in Oregon, I'm surprised anyone gets away with it. I'm surprised somebody hasn't sued them. Because in Oregon, it is amazing how many rights and protections we have. But I mean, my own insurance company is a perfect example. Is I fought them for 2 years because both my two physicians and my mental health counselor said top surgery was necessary for my mental health. And they came back and said, no, it's cosmetic. And I fought for 2 years and got nowhere. And then one day they called me up and said, well, we've changed our policies. We're going to pay for it now. I was like, oh, okay, cool, thanks. So it is changing, but the fact that it's not changing fast enough and the amount of stress that places on transgender people is unfortunate.
Josh.
Hey, Bethany, thank you for being here and for your presentation. My name is Josh Burstein. I'm a City Club board member and member since 2011. You said earlier, it just can't be news anymore that I exist. People are more, I take notes, sorry. People are more than their identity. People are tired of being tokenized. And my question is, how do you square that with your research where you're going out to meet people, you're doing the studies, you're interviewing them around the fact that they're transgender? So how does that fit, and how do they react to you, and versus how might they have reacted to someone who, an investigator, a researcher, a PhD student who was not transgender?
I have no doubt that I get interviews with people because I'm transgender that other researchers wouldn't. I get told that a lot. In terms of, do I find it contradictory? I guess in some ways I do. But what I would say is that I can envision a perfect world where my identity is not a big deal. I mean, I'm always going to stick out, and I get that. But it's like, if you've ever been in New York City, you see like Orthodox and Hasidic Jews walking around, and they're in their robes and very long beards and hats. And it's not like when you see them standing at the corner of Fifth and Avenue of the Americas, and you go, oh my God, it's Gandalf! No, they're part of the normal patina of New York City, if still visually distinct. That's all I want to be. I want to be visually distinct, but I don't need people screaming at me across the street, which happens to people. And I want that world to exist, but it doesn't exist. And in fact, it exists in a space where that stress is literally killing us. And as much as I would like to believe that the world's going to get better, until it does, doing what I do and knowing what I know, I have a responsibility to go and find out what the problem is so I can make it better. If I thought that me talking to people about this was making them worse, and I've actually kind of investigated that from my own standpoint, I wouldn't do it. But the fact that I think I've found what they call a social science construct that nobody else has found, and it's a construct that's killing people, I guess what I would say is, to have the privilege that I have to investigate it and to not investigate it would be irresponsible.
Hi, John DeLow, City Club member. And I got a difficult question for you. Has anybody found any physical reason why someone in a man's body feels they should be a female?
If you're asking if it's a yes and no. There is a lot of what you might call anecdotal stuff. There's a recent study that showed that if you look at the brainwave activity of transgender women, that their innate brain patterns more match women that were
men and women, biological men and women, have distinct kind of brainwave patterns. Transgender women, even though they were born physically with male genitalia, have brain patterns that match women's. It's a very limited study. It's a brand new one. We'll see if that holds up. There are other things. For instance, one of the things I read, and again, they don't know this, but if you've ever looked at men and women, men can rotate their arm and then hold it down here. You can take your finger and hold it along your thigh. Women can't do that. Women get down to about here and it stops. And the theory on that is that from an evolutionary perspective, what it does is it allows your arms to fold up in a way that allows you to hold a child to your breast. So men's arms hang straight, women's arms pronate at the elbow out from the thigh. You can see mine don't do that. Now, does that mean anything? I don't know. There is an enormous search right now there's a lot of people investing a lot of time to prove that transgender identity is born. It is innate. It is not up here. Because they see it as a means of justifying our equal existence in the court of law. And I guess my thought on that is, I don't care. And what I mean by that is, I'm not saying I'm not for science, I am, but what if they give me my test and it comes back and it says I'm not? Does that mean that what I know about myself is wrong? I don't want to get into that. But also, we live in a society where we recognize that people have identities, both inborn and chosen, and we recognize both of them. I mean, it's not like you tell me you're Catholic, and it's like, all right, show me your beads. How many you got? Oh, that's not enough beads. I'm sorry, you're not Catholic. It's like if somebody tells you they're gay, and it's like, all right, grab that guy over there. You, do that beach scene from Here to Eternity. Come on, in the surf. No, we accept it. We believe them. And so I believe in science, and I want to see this move forward. But as to do I need or am I looking for a physical, biological reason that I am the way I am, that transgender people are the way they are? No, I don't need one. I know who I am.
And on that note, we will end this portion of the presentation.
One last thing is, I do this a lot, and I thought I was going to move and leave Eugene. As it turns out, I kind of fell in love with this silly city, and so I'm staying. If any of you ever need anything, please don't hesitate to ask. I'm always happy to help. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we thank Bethany Grace, I'd like to tell you about some upcoming programs we have next week. What's Working in Lane County? Eric Richardson will be here at the podium on Wednesday, March 27th. We have Community Spotlight down at Tsunami Books at 6 o'clock with local activist Connor Gaber. We hope that you will attend these programs, and for all the programs that are upcoming, check our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let's thank our speaker, Bethany Grace Howe, for a wonderful program. Thanks, folks.